Hey, it's Jenny here. Before we get started with the podcast, I want to thank all of you for your patience in waiting for this last episode of Holding It Together for 2018. I spent much of October and November planning for and then coming back to myself from Women Doing Theology. On the last day of the conference, I was completely blown away by the beautiful words of gratitude that so many of you offered to me. And honestly, I was too exhausted to form coherent sentences beyond, thank you so much, or I'm so glad. So I wanted to take a moment and personally thank all of you who attended this event. I think together we really created something beautiful. I am so, so grateful to the planning committee, Chantel Todman and Melissa Flora Bixler, who gave so much of themselves to this event, and to the Women in Leadership Steering Committee who envisioned it. I will continue to sing the praises of our brilliant large group presenters, Dr. Melinda Elizabeth Berry, Reverend Yvette Blair, and Carolina Hinojosa Cisneros. Your offerings were challenging, thought-provoking, and honest. And to all of you who offered papers or workshops, planned and led worship, served as chaplains, led autonomous and accountability spaces, volunteered, served food, engaged in conversation, listened. Know that what you offered contributed to this thing we did together. Thank you. Now for the podcast.
Going through fertility treatments is something sort of beyond what I would have imagined it to be as far as how taxing it was. And I was just so thankful. You know, I had a couple key people in my life who I could call at the drop of the hat when I'm, you know, standing there needing to do my day's injections and just didn't quite have the courage to do it. Or there's just so much power in relationships that come alongside and that find ways to hold the pain with you and not try to downplay it, not try to take it away, but just accompany.
Rachel Epp Miller has worked as a pastor, seniors companion, piano teacher, and most recently, a full-time stay-at-home parent. She loves spending time outdoors, playing piano, baking, tending backyard chickens, and sharing daily life with her husband, Wendell, and her almost 6-year-old son, Ira. They live in San Antonio, Texas.
When Susanna was in the NICU, we were praying for her strength. Then we were praying for a miracle of healing, and there were hundreds of people praying with us for that, and it didn't happen. And there were some moments afterward that I said to God, I asked you for one thing, and it wasn't even that hard. She had a 50% chance of surviving. So I'm not going to ask for anything again.
Sarah Ann Bixler is the mother of three living children, and she's married to Benjamin Bixler. They live in Princeton, New Jersey, and attend Oxford Circle Mennonite Church in Philadelphia. Sarah is a PhD student in practical theology at Princeton Theological Seminary. Previously, she lived in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where she worked as a youth minister, teacher, and conference administrator. Back in September, Rachel and Sarah agreed to be part of our Breaking Silences series, and they sat down together to have a conversation about infertility, miscarriage, and infant loss. 6% of women in the United States are unable to get pregnant after 1 year of trying. 12% of women in the U.S. have trouble getting pregnant and carrying pregnancy to term. 15 to 20% of all pregnancies in the U.S. end in miscarriage. In the United States, about 66,000 babies die each year within their first month of life. With statistics like these, undoubtedly, infertility, miscarriage, or infant loss have affected someone we know and care about. But are we aware? Have we created space for people experiencing these things to share about what they're going through? Today, we're breaking silences. We're releasing the stigma, the shame, and the fear. And we're talking about infertility, miscarriage, and infant loss. Rolled into that, we're also talking about women's bodies, anger, love, sex, hope, guilt, and so much more.
When I was pregnant for the second time and my son was a toddler, my husband and I were excited to learn that we were expecting another child, and we shared it freely with friends and family and in our congregation where I was a youth minister at the time. Our excitement didn't last for long. Several weeks into the pregnancy, I discovered at an appointment that the child was no longer living inside me, and that I had had an early miscarriage. But I hadn't known because the child was still within me. I elected not to go to the hospital right away for a D&C procedure, but instead to wait and let the miscarriage run its course, which happened 4 weeks later. Several months later, I became pregnant again, and this time our hope was much more guarded. I experienced a lot of bleeding early in the pregnancy. I was placed on modified bed rest at one point, but after the 20th week, it looked like things were going well. Within a few weeks, though, I went into early labor, and our daughter, Susanna, was born 13 weeks premature. She lived for a week in the neonatal intensive care unit at the hospital. I had another miscarriage in 2012. And it happened on Mother's Day, of all days. And again, that was an early miscarriage. Today, my husband and I have 3 living children and 3 children we know of who are not with us.
Our journey with infertility began about 3 years ago when we decided that we were ready to try to conceive a second child. We had a 2.5-year-old son at that time. And when pregnancy wasn't happening and me being in my late 30s, we decided to see a doctor. And she eventually sent us to the fertility clinic here in San Antonio, where we spent, I don't know, about 7 or 8 months trying a variety of interventions to get pregnant. And that was a really difficult journey just with the medical system, as well as sort of the invasive procedures that are part of that, physically demanding, financially demanding, and emotionally taxing for sure. And the journey with fertility treatments ultimately did not lead to pregnancy. And so it's been 1.5 years since the end of that, that has been marked by a deep grief and a growing acceptance that pregnancy will not be part of the journey going forward.
We have asked the question why over and over again and in so many different ways. And sometimes other people have tried to help address that question with and for us, sometimes more helpful than others. And when we're faced with this lack of explanation, like what you just described in the fertility treatments that you underwent, that question, why, just lingers. Do you want to say more about that, Rachel, and the failure of the medical community to provide you with answers to why?
I've thought a lot about the question why and how it's such a useless question, even though it's so inevitable. It's what inevitably comes up for us and we wrestle with, even when there's really no answer to it at all. And I think what I've been struck with in this whole journey, especially with the medical establishment, you know, that's based on science and the best practices that they've come up with over the decades. And still, there's so much mystery as part of this and so much inability to explain or to control the outcomes. And each cycle that we went in for, you know, there was lots of testing and ultrasounds and blood work and all kinds of things leading up sort of to the main event. And each time everything for me and my husband looked perfect. They were always saying, like, everything looks perfect. You know, we're really hopeful. And so when it never happened, yeah, you really wrestle with, well, what is going wrong here? And then you start questioning other things in your own life beyond sort of the medical, physical aspects of trying to conceive. You start kind of scouring your marriage relationship. And like you said, there's people who often are giving their intended to be helpful kind of words and advice. I had people telling me, well, maybe if you go off gluten, or maybe once you stop fertility treatments, you'll get pregnant by some magic. those kinds of comments were kind of hard to receive because I was already asking all those questions for myself. And the question why is really, really hard. And somewhere in the midst of it, I think I started trying to shift the question to, well, why not? Why should I not be one of the 10% of women who have this experience of infertility, or I forget what the stat is, 3 million couples who experience secondary infertility, which means you've already had a biological child and now for whatever reason you're facing infertility. And so I got some comfort actually in that why not question, feeling a little less alone maybe in the midst of it.
For me, the statistics became real on one hand and then almost obsolete on the other hand because it was me. So I'm aware that 1 in 4 women will experience miscarriage or infant loss in their lifetime. And that when our daughter was born prematurely, she had a 50% chance of thriving in the NICU, and she didn't. And how even for me, there was no medical explanation for the miscarriages that I had had. The doctor identified that my cervix was weak, whatever that means. and so that maybe was an explanation for my preterm labor, but I had had a perfectly healthy child in my first pregnancy at term. And so the statistics and the medical explanations didn't work. And it turned me to theological questions as well. So why would God allow this to happen to me? Worse yet, is this God's will? And people gave different theological explanations for it. And to be quite honest, most of them I found pretty flimsy, saying things like, well, this must have happened for the best. Or even the answer, we can't ever know why, because God's ways are higher than ours. Even that kind of a response wasn't necessarily helpful at a time where I already felt distant from God, and that contributed to that distance. For me, my questions of why, they didn't have an answer, but eventually they were replaced by what I sensed was a presence from God. They were kind of answered in an indirect way by God's Spirit reminding me of the where of God. So my questions of why were helped by the question of where is God in all this? And I found that God was there with me, with our family, with my children, and that I felt that God was suffering along with us. And that was enough to satisfy the why questions that couldn't be answered.
This whole podcast is about sharing things that are hard to talk about. And there's a great vulnerability to share the things that are happening in our personal lives, whatever they are, but these have added layers of loss and grief, have added layers of things that have happened in our bodies and to our bodies, as well as to our hopes and dreams. And because of some of the flimsy theology, like you said, that we've sometimes been faced with from others, well-meaning as they are, it's, for me, was hard to know how to bring this to my faith community, or do I bring this to my faith community? I mean, this is such a private thing. This is something, you know, you don't talk about trying to conceive, or like that's, yeah. That's the whole sex realm, you know, that you don't talk about at church. And so I really wrestled with that, and it took about 1.5 years into this whole journey of trying to conceive to name it to my faith community in a more public kind of way. And even then, I really wasn't sure if that was the right thing to do or if that was a good thing to do for me. I mean, in the end, I think I'm glad I did. I think there came a point in my journey where it felt important to name the journey more broadly. And I think this podcast is one piece of that also for me. At some point, it feels like the private becoming public can be an act of healing in itself too. And so naming that to the faith community was good. And I received a lot of support, even as I also received some responses that kind of fed some of that uncertainty and pain as well. But yeah, the question of how and when and if to share is a pretty big one. And you said that you were in the midst of pastoral leadership as a youth pastor when some of this experience for you anyway happened. And that adds another layer to it. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Yeah, in my first miscarriage, we had told families in the church that we were pregnant again. And so when I found out that there was no heartbeat anymore, then I had to explain that. I remember distinctly there was one evening with the high school youth group where we were having prayer. And of course, I had acknowledged this. And one of the youth asked what it was like, what I was feeling. And I said, I don't know how to explain it. It feels really strange to be walking around knowing that I'm carrying a dead child inside me. And I was just totally forthright about that. And I think my honesty in that situation helped to demonstrate the wrestling with faith in the midst of these human experiences of pain and confusion. That is the stuff that faith is made of. And that there are not always answers, and that doesn't mean we don't have faith or that we don't believe that God is there even when we can't feel God in the moment. It was also really hard sometimes to hide my emotions of grief. It still is sometimes. I remember in particular, there was a sermon on the breath of God within a few months of when my child had died because her lungs weren't strong enough. I wept through the entire sermon, and I'm sure my faith community noticed. It was really hard for me for a while to hear Psalm 139, "You knit me together in my mother's womb," has been a really triggering passage for me, for my grief. And every Advent, I still have tension when we celebrate Mary's pregnancy. And we know that all around us, and including in myself, our bodies have not been able to conceive or carry children to term. So I think that it's really important for us, if and when we are ready, to be able to share these difficult experiences in the faith community. It also allowed me to work through it with others. There were a lot of people who came up to me and shared that they too had had a miscarriage. Some of them even had lost children or infants to unexpected or early death. And I was amazed to see how much me sharing my experience brought so many others' people's experiences to light, and we could connect over that grief. There was also a man who shared with me about several times that there had been failed adoptions for his family, and that was a connection as well. And so we were able to bring these questions to one another within the faith community and just hold them together. It was also hard for me, being in a position of ministry at the time, to bear this grief and emptiness in my own body, and then also to be in a position of ministry toward others and to be a minister like in the body of Christ. There was so much complexity in that for me. And I found that people ministered to me as well, that ministry was not just a one-way street, and that many people in the congregation, in particular in my case, ministered to me in ways that I needed very deeply. You mentioned that you waited about a year and a half to say anything about your experience with infertility. What happened when you did share?
Sharing did lead, like you said, I mean, my faith community too was very caring, and I also, that same morning, heard from a number of women who had experienced different things, some infertility, some pregnancy loss. I'm always amazed when we share our stories, how it opens up the stories of others as well. And it's a very powerful gift we can offer to one another. One of the things I came away from that morning with that was more difficult were the comments about prayer that people offered. And I was really grateful to hear that people were going to be praying for me and for my family. When I had shared, we were about to go into our last round of in vitro. And so we were carrying a sense of hope, certainly, that maybe this would work this time, as well as a heaviness knowing it was our last try. And so a lot of people said they would pray for us, and I was really grateful for that. I really welcomed people's prayers. But there was also a sense from some that their prayers would be effective towards my pregnancy. And I struggled with that a lot more. I didn't know what to do with that because I was going into the last round and, you know, I forget the statistics, but, you know, it was about a 20 to 30% chance that this was actually going to result in pregnancy, which isn't, in my book, very high. The doctors were very hopeful, but I wasn't sure how to receive that kind of prayer. It felt like they were saying, if we sit down and pray together, you will get pregnant. I mean, I don't know that they would have said it so clearly, but that's how it felt. And so sort of contrast that with a circle of women who got together and just wanted to create space for me to share my story. And we did that, and we prayed together, not that I'd get pregnant so much as that God would accompany us through our hardest days and light a way forward. And that felt a lot more true and healing to me, to be able to join a circle of folks who aren't trying to fix it or to find answers to the question why when there aren't any answers, but to just kind of hold it together was what was most meaningful to me. And I think through it all too, I'd say that going through fertility treatments is something sort of beyond what I would have imagined it to be as far as how taxing it was. And I was just so thankful. You know, I had a couple key people in my life who I could call at the drop of the hat when I'm, you know, standing there needing to do my day's injections and just didn't quite have the courage to do it. Or there's just so much power in relationships that come alongside and that find ways to hold the pain with you and not try to downplay it, not try to take it away, but just accompany. And I'm really grateful that I experienced that many times on this journey. And I think, like you said, Sarah, it translates from, I mean, I experienced that from friends and family, but I think it also translates into sort of theological perspectives, right? I mean, it's how I believe God works with us. It's not the pray harder so God will give you what your heart desires. It's
right.
You pray so that you have a sense that, you know, you're not abandoned, but you are accompanied. You know, you're accompanied through these really dark places sometimes. And God doesn't take away the mess. You know, God doesn't wipe it away, doesn't deny it or even try to fix it so much as says, no, this is where we need to sit a while, right here in the mess. And, you know, something will be beyond this, but right now we have to just sit in the mess together. And that's sort of my hope that I've come to too, is that God's there in the mess.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rachel, that that's how I've come to understand the way God works too. It's a being with, and that's the most powerful experience we can have is the presence of God. And it's a presence that is more healing than any systematic theology that I have ever read. My understanding of prayer changed too. You mentioned that, Rachel. When Susanna was in the NICU, we were praying for her strength. Then we were praying for a miracle of healing, and there were hundreds of people praying with us for that, and it didn't happen. And there were some moments afterward that I said to God, I asked you for one thing, and it wasn't even that hard. She had a 50% chance of surviving. So I'm not going to ask for anything again. And that's how I felt for a while. And God was still with me. And the presence of God helped me to understand that when God meets us in our prayer, that's the greatest response that God can have, is to be there when we pray. And that my prayers now have become much less of asking for specific things and putting a lot of boundaries around that. I still don't shy away from saying what I long for, but my prayers are much more open-ended now. And I realize that the way God is moving in this world is not something that I can really anticipate, but that it's the presence of God that I long for and that I need, and that is a healing power for me. I've also found that my sense of hope has been changed, and that when I think about what God can do, while I have maybe a greater imagination for what is possible, my hope is a little bit more guarded than it used to be, because I have hope for things that have not come to be. And it was very painful. And I still think that guarded hope is really hope. But when we have been let down, when we have experienced pain or trauma, our hope changes too. And it's a little bit different for me than what it used to be. There is a trauma psychologist named Kata Weingarten, whose work I have found really helpful in naming this as reasonable hope. Hope that is more realistic, and it takes into account the ways we have been let down in the past. And it directs our attention to what is perhaps within reach rather than what we desire that we know nothing about. She talks about reasonable hope as something that is relational, that recognizes that the future is open, but also accommodates doubt and despair, all in the same thing. And so for me, a lot of healing has occurred around being able to walk with others, particularly my spouse, in that relational space, holding our doubt and our despair and the contradictions that we have experienced in our faith through this pain of miscarriage and infant loss, and having hope for something, but not prescribing what that is and allowing the future to be more open than what I had expected. So when my husband and I experienced the death of our daughter, Susanna, we were told that a very high percentage, and I don't remember what it is, but a very high percentage of marriages that experience the death of a child end in divorce. And it's really understandable because it's really hard to walk together through that kind of loss. And so for Ben and me, part of the way this challenge showed up was in the tension in our sexual relationship. I was on bed rest at certain points where our sexual intimacy was restricted. I had had invasive medical procedures of different sorts, like the DNC, after my miscarriage to make sure that there was nothing left in my uterus. That was an invasive surgical procedure. I had a lot more obstetrician exams than I can count because they were always checking on things. And giving birth is an experience as well that really changes and it impacts the ability to have sex with your spouse. This introduced tension into our relationship. Sometimes we were restricted. Other times it was hard emotionally to experience sexual pleasure because of the effects of these invasive procedures that had happened to me in my body. When we had our miscarriages and we're trying to conceive again, there was also then this expectation that we had to have sex at certain times when I was ovulating, and there was added pressure on our sexual intimacy. And I came to discover when we were finally able to communicate about this in a healthy way, that there was a need for us to separate the beauty of the sexual intimacy in our marriage from the act of procreation. Not to separate them in an unhealthy way, but to recognize that our sexual intimacy is not reduced to procreation, and that there is great meaning there, whether or not we're able to conceive a child, and whether or not my body carries the child to term.
Sarah, that resonates with me a lot, even though our journeys are different. When you're undergoing fertility treatments, the amount of pokes and prods that were part of my weekly existence for months and months, and sometimes multiple times a week, getting ovarian and uterine ultrasounds done, and it's very invasive. And then you go home from your appointment with a sheet of paper that says exactly what you do on what dates, you know, whether it's the drug regimen or whether it's when you can have sex with your husband, when you can't have sex with your husband, when you have to have sex with your husband. I mean, it's absolutely nuts on a relationship. We came through that bearing the weight of it in different ways. Certainly me, because it was happening in my body and to my body, but both of us emotionally carrying it in our own ways. And my son too, even though as a preschooler at that time, he wasn't really fully aware of what all was going on, but I was a stay-at-home mom, and so he had to accompany me to a lot of appointments. And we realized at one point that we needed to talk with him even more openly than we had been when he asked me one day on the way home from the doctor's if I was sick. Like, he was starting to worry that, you know, we were going to the doctor's because something was really wrong. And at that point, we realized, okay, no, we need to be even more open about what this is. And he would express his own hopes of having a little brother or sister. And in his own ways, he would try to make sense of what he was witnessing and what he was hearing us talk about, and no doubt sensing some of the stress in our lives. But, you know, I'm really grateful to this 3-4-year-old kid who was my joy through so much of this process. That was coupled with a deep feeling of guilt, actually, that was part of this process for me. Knowing that here I was going through the fertility treatments and hoping for another child, and sitting in the waiting room surrounded by people whose stories I didn't know, but probably the vast majority of them just wished to be parents. And here I was, I am a mom, and I felt a great deal of guilt for wanting another child so badly. I can empathize and resonate with the pain that's in that fertility clinic waiting room, even as I didn't know the depths of it. Because I am a mom, and I'm really thankful to be a mom to this amazing, vibrant 5-year-old kid. And I've really wanted to feel like that's enough. And most of the time I do. I'm really thankful for my family, even as we've had to let go of some other hopes.
Some people asked us whether we would tell our son about the conditions of his sister in the hospital. We believe that it was most healthy for him to not be in the dark about that. And so we did our best to try to explain what was going on. And he had the chance to meet his sister one time. The NICU staff kind of snuck him in a back door because there weren't supposed to be children in that space. For us, there came a point, though, where we realized that we weren't explaining things in the best way to him. We prayed every evening before bed with our son, and soon after his sister died, I asked him, "Are you ready to pray?" And he said, "No." He didn't want to pray. And as I talked with him, I realized it had been because I had been saying to him, "Susanna lives with Jesus now. He had been asking, where is she? What happened to her? And he was concluding that Jesus had taken her away from us, which again is an extraordinary theological question that I was struggling with too at the very same time. And so his articulation of that theological problem was clearer than any words I could put to what I was feeling inside. And to be able to work through that at the cognitive level of a 2-year-old was very, very helpful for me.
On the first day of kindergarten, my son, who's now 5, brought home a handful of dried kidney beans. And he's like, Mom, we need to plant these. And I said, okay, we can plant these. And the thing about kidney beans is that they sprout really fast. Like within a couple days, you know, you can see that they're breaking open and there's a shoot going, you know, some roots coming down and a shoot going up. And you can watch the progress sort of every day. You know, we would check the beans and they'd be different. Every time we looked at them, they were bigger. And now they're growing in our garden and have blossoms on them. And in the journeys that we face that are hard and where we, you know, ask a lot of questions and really wrestle towards answers that sometimes don't come, we don't usually see that kind of rapid sprouting or growth, right? We're not kidney beans, unfortunately, in this way. That would be nice. We'd watch our growth day by day, hour by hour, and we'd see stuff happening, but it doesn't really work that way. It's much, much slower to traverse the dark places in our lives. But I take comfort in this image of the seed because the seed starts out in the dark. It starts in the dark of the earth. And I also take some comfort in the image of it needing to break open, right? And I think that's what happens in our lives is that our hearts break open again and again. Whenever we open ourselves to hope or love or, you know, any of these big things that make life worth living, we risk the breaking open of our hearts. And that's what happens to the seed as well, right? It breaks open and then something new emerges in its own time, in a time beyond the seed's control, beyond its ability to maybe even dream of what it could be, what could come out of this dark kind of place of the earth. But something new comes out of it, some new beauty, some new, you know, even functioning, some new hope. So that's the image I've clung to, is this thing that sits and rests in the dark. And I still feel like my life right now, this journey for me, is still existing a lot of the time in the dark. And I've been broken open. And sometimes I get glimpses of the sort of new roots and sprouts that are coming. And I see reasons to hope in my life and in my family and in this journey even. I can see that God's working and something is gonna come of it that, you know, I perhaps couldn't have imagined or embraced before I had to live this.
Thanks, Rachel. Thank you, Sarah, for your courage in sharing from your heart and from your experiences. I pray that in our individual lives, in our relationships and communities, that we'd stretch ourselves to accompany one another and to resist the urge to fix it or offer easy answers. I pray that we'd meet one another, even in the deep darkness, and create spaces to hold each other's stories. This episode was produced by me, Jenny Castro, with editing help from Shay Langley. Our theme music was written and recorded by the very talented Addie Lichty. To find more music by Addie, look for Addie the Subtracts on Facebook and Addie Lichty on YouTube. Holding It Together is a joint production of Mennonite Church USA's Office of Women in Leadership and the Mennonite Inc. Look for us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Fireside, or wherever you prefer. If you have a second, I'd invite you to rate and review us. And please share the podcast with your friends. I'm your host, Jenny Gostrel. Thanks for listening, y'all. Talk soon. That's my religion.